It's 2020, and a lot of things we thought would have happened by now are still not reality, like flying cars. But some kinds of social change have happened so fast that the legal framework around them hasn't kept pace. One example is transgender awareness. A decade ago, many Americans still didn't even know what that term meant. Now there are sympathetic transgender characters on network television shows. Transgender celebrities like Caitlyn Jenner and Laverne Cox are on the covers of fashion magazines, and people are coming out as transgender pretty young. Consider Kansas City's own Avery Jackson. At age 9, she was the first transgender person to be pictured on the cover of National Geographic. Avery is about the most confident 9-year-old I've ever met.
If you have a trans kid, you should just let them be them.
But being out and having to advocate for yourself still isn't always easy as a young person. Avery told me about that when the magazine was on the stands in 2017.
Well, you're going to be getting hate and...
What kind of hate?
Well, just people saying things that you aren't going in the right bathroom, or just that's not who you are, when they have no idea. They technically have no choice to tell me who I am.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're going to meet a KU law professor who's trying to help the education system and the law catch up. She's just written a comprehensive guide to ensuring Title IX protections for transgender students. It's very thorough, and it's groundbreaking. Let's hear about it now. Kyle Velty, welcome to KCUR Central Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Are the young Averys out there trying to navigate school settings the reason why an article like the one you've just published felt urgent to you?
Definitely. As you noted on the top of the show, this has been an emerging issue in the last decade or so, particularly with youth. And we're seeing more and more young children come out as transgender earlier and earlier. And schools were largely unprepared for this because it is a new issue. And so they have been navigating what Title IX requires, as have advocates on the outside and the families themselves.
Avery mentioned bathrooms. Bathrooms are a big part of this, right?
Yes, definitely. There's a lot of cultural anxiety about proper bathroom use, and it's one of the biggest issues that is kind of percolating in terms of putting people at ease around full equality and inclusion for transgender folks.
What are some of the other things people might be less aware of, forms of discrimination that transgender students face in the school setting, whether we're talking grade school, high school, or college? And then maybe walk us through how Title IX, as it exists and gets interpreted, either does or doesn't protect those students.
Yeah, I think the biggest challenges right now for trans kids are in the K-12 setting, because as anyone who has a K-12 student knows, we gender divide our kids. We segregate them by gender, sometimes from the moment they are there. Boys line up over here, girls line up over here. And so there's the binary is imposed on K-12 education, and there's a lot of sex segregation that happens there from physical education and bathrooms, as you note. But, you know, there's some real health issues for kids who are transgender and aren't allowed to use the bathroom that aligns with their gender identity. For example, some of them will not drink a lot during the day and be subject to dehydration. Others will just not use the restroom all day long and be subject to kidney infections or UTI infections and things like that. So there's health consequences to this kind of thing. There can be bullying that happens from peers or even from teachers that can lead to adverse health outcomes like suicidal ideation, higher suicide attempts. Health outcomes overall data points show that trans kids have worse health outcomes when there's not a supportive environment, both in school and at home.
What exactly is Title IX? I mean, we hear people refer to Title IX a lot, and I think most of us understand that it has to do with gender discrimination in schools. But beyond that, I mean, how would you describe what that is?
Yeah, it's actually like a one-sentence law. It's a federal law. It was about 60 years old at this point, 50 years old in the early 1970s. And most folks think about it about sports, right? That in the 70s, colleges had to come up with lots of girls and women's sports programs to satisfy Title IX. And that's a huge component of the law. But it touches every area of education that is sex-based in any way. And it basically says no one in the U.S. shall be discriminated against on the basis of sex, can't be excluded from participating or denied the benefits of any educational program or activity that receives federal funds, which essentially is every school in this country, even private schools. If students are receiving federal financial aid, they're subject to Title IX as well.
So why is there debate right now about the extent to which Title IX protects transgender students?
Precisely because the term that's used in the statute is based on the basis of sex. And so the courts and the administration has been trying to interpret, what does sex mean in this? Does sex incorporate gender identity or sexual orientation? The Supreme Court actually right now has three cases in front of it that involve employment discrimination in Title VII, which is also a federal law that says you cannot be discriminated against based on sex in employment. And courts often use those cases from Title VII to interpret Title IX. And so this question before the court now is, does because of sex include sexual orientation and gender identity, will have a huge impact when it comes out, likely in June, on these Title IX cases as well. But I will say nearly every court that's considered the Title IX question has said, yes, sex does encompass within it. The term sex in the statute encompasses within it both gender identity and sexual orientation. And I'm happy to talk in more detail about that.
Yeah,
if you'd like.
No, I mean, it seems like the fact that we have historically interpreted sex as a binary thing is part of what gets tricky here, that it's not just in the law that that's been interpreted that way. It's in the education system, in so many customs that are still practiced. So where these two things intersect, it's just kind of a new world in so many ways.
Absolutely. Society and law both are binary in that way. And as we see more emerging numbers of gender non-binary people, right, which is a different concept than transgender, that will, I think, push the law even more, even to a greater extent than transgender folks do, because transgender folks generally still want to check off the M or the F box. It's gender non-binary people that want an X on their driver's license rather than an M or F. And that, I think, is the real challenge that we're going to see coming down the pike for the law.
But you connect this issue around Title IX with a fight for documents that reflect a transgender person's lived reality as opposed to the gender assigned at birth. So documents like birth certificates and, as they get older, driver's licenses. Talk to me about that issue on its own and then explain how it relates to Title IX. So we'll get to Title IX in a minute. Just first of all, this documents issue.
Yes. Having the correct gender marker on all of your identity documents is very, very important. For example, if you're a transgender woman, which means you were born a man, you're assigned male sex at birth, and now you're living life as a woman, if your birth certificate still has a male identifier on there and you are presenting as a woman because that's your gender identity and you are in fact a woman, then if an employer needs to see your birth certificate or your driver's license and it has the wrong gender marker on it, lots of bad outcomes can flow from that, right? If you're pulled over by the police and you appear as a woman, but there's an M on your driver's license, you could be subject to harassment or allegations of fraud or identity theft or all sorts of negative consequences, from just mere harassment to downright violence. And so having those aligned is extremely important, particularly from the birth certificate, which is known as a breeder document, right? Every other document kind of flows from the birth certificate, particularly when you're registering your kids in school. Often they say, I'd like to, you need to register them with a birth certificate, and that's how the child is gendered through all K through 12, from testing to class rosters to which restroom they're going to use. And so that's where we see the intersection between the importance of gender markers being correct on identity documents and Title IX. And states vary on what they permit and how you go about changing your gender marker on everything from a birth certificate to a Social Security card to a passport to a driver's license.
You work in Kansas. So, for example, where is Kansas on those things?
Kansas is really in a really good space right now. Until last year, Kansas was one of the states where it was practically prohibited to ever change your birth certificate. But due to some litigation by some wonderful activists and advocates here in the Kansas City area, we had a consent decree, an agreement between the parties where now you can change your birth certificate in Kansas without having gender confirmation surgery if that's something that you don't want or need as a transgender person. And you really can do it with much greater ease than you could before.
What initially brought this issue of Title IX and its implications for transgender students to your attention as something for a legal scholar to take on?
Mostly personal experience, as well as my scholarly interests. I have written in LGBTQ civil rights issues since I became a scholar and a law professor, but I also have friends whose kids are trans, and hearing their stories and being involved in the community generally on community boards and as an activist, you start to hear stories over the last 10 or so years about trans kids in the school system. And
What kinds of things were you hearing?
Generally, I was in Colorado at the time, which was a very affirming state. And so generally, I was hearing good stories, right, about how schools were being responsive to these. But it also took a lot of parental advocacy of meeting with principals, meeting with school boards, saying, here's best practices. There's a lot of educative work that needs to be done within the school board itself and the school districts. But certainly, as a legal scholar, with emphasis on the legal, as soon as I started hearing these personal stories, my first question was, and how can the law help? And that's what led me to this article.
There are two court cases in progress now, I understand, that are likely to establish some kind of precedent on this. Can you tell us about those cases?
I imagine those were the Title VII cases that I was referring to just a couple of minutes ago.
So yeah. Three cases.
Exactly. There's two cases where gay men were fired from their jobs, and there's a third case where a transgender woman was fired from her job. All three of those cases were put together in one little group for the Supreme Court to hear, and that is looking, as I said, at a statute called Title VII, which says you can't discriminate in employment based on sex. And the question is exactly that. Does the term sex encompass sexual orientation? Does it encompass gender identity? And the court should issue those decisions no later than the middle of June, and they will have a huge impact not only on employment law but also on Title IX, because so many courts borrow the rulings from the Title VII employment context to apply in the Title IX context because the statutory language is very similar.
Is there anything about the school setting that is different for students than the employment setting for employees?
Well, I would say that no matter which context you're in, if you're a transgender person, it's important to be protected, recognized, and celebrated. But certainly kids lack the agency of adults in many ways. And so, you know, they don't have a lot of control over their schedule or what they do in schools. They're subject to many, many rules. And so I think they're particularly vulnerable, right, in needing of these kinds of protections and best practices.
Part of what you're doing in this article that we've been talking about is you are challenging what's known as the surgical requirement for Title IX protections as they stand. What is the surgical requirement?
So in 16 states, you must have proof of gender confirmation surgery, which was used to be known as sex reassignment surgery. And so if you're a transgender person and you want to get a new gender marker on your birth certificate, in those 16 states, you have to have that surgery. Many, many transgender folks don't feel like it's necessary for them to live as their true gender identity to have that kind of surgery. Others can't afford it, and others, it's not medically suited for them. And so to have the surgery requirement to change that gender marker on the birth certificate, and then all the stuff that flows from that birth certificate, like in some states, driver's licenses and school segregation in terms of sex facilities is really a huge obstacle. And Missouri is one of those 16 states that requires proof of surgery to change your gender marker on your birth certificate. It's a huge obstacle, and it's not supported by either medical or psychological best practices about what it means to transition for a transgender person.
You know, I have a story that might make some of this a little more concrete for people. Do you mind if I tell this story?
Sure, go for it.
So, I have a relative who identifies as transgender, and they use the pronoun they. They have not had surgery for a really wide range of personal reasons, including health issues that would complicate the surgery. They work at a university as a researcher, and because they couldn't get their preferred name on their diploma years ago, they now can't do that thing of putting a diploma on the wall, which is not a huge deal on its own, but it relates to all these other things, because in academia, you're the thing that says, I have a PhD, I have a master's, I have all those things, is a very big deal. But also, their academic records dead name them all the time, as does their caller ID and university email account. And this is a fight that this person has been fighting for years and years and years.
Yes, and not atypical. It's really institution to institution. There are a lot of resources out there on different advocacy groups that have kind of toolkits and guides and best practices and how to go about these things. I've worked at other institutions where the administration has very quickly and promptly said, yes, you're transitioning. We will change all of those records for you. And my understanding is that University of Kansas is a part of that movement of making it easier for transgender students to change their name and their gender marker.
But it's on a university by university basis right now?
Correct. And certainly students could think about asserting a Title IX claim if their request is denied in that way. But litigation is not always the right path or the right answer. And hopefully the education component through advocacy work can help change these policies without litigation, which can be by definition adversarial and negative. And to the extent we can work as a community and recognize transgender folks are all around us, they have been for generations and generations and generations, contributing to society in ways that we don't even know because they were closeted or passing. I think that's the way to get there, is saying let's come together as a community and support these folks and raise them up to equal protection and equal status in our communities.
What is the framework that you've provided for challenging that surgical requirement?
Several. I've talked about kind of bioethics and best practices medically speaking, but I've also laid out some legal arguments under the Constitution about the First Amendment.
Can you give an example?
Sure. There's one argument that under the First Amendment free speech, that the government can't compel you to send a government message. And if the government is requiring you to have surgery before you can change your birth certificate, the government is telling you to speak a message about what gender means and how gender is displayed. And that is constitutionally impermissible under the First Amendment. So that's one example. There's also some states that have anti-discrimination laws that include prohibitions on discriminating based on transgender gender identity. You could bring cases under that as well. And so there's multiple ways to think about legal challenges to these surgical requirements.
How does this look the same or different at various stages within the education system? So like grade school versus high school versus college?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I mentioned before, at least when one gets to college, one has more autonomy over one's day and control over the comings and goings and where one spends time in different spaces, as opposed to K through 12. I'm giving a vague answer because it really does depend on the particular school district. And there's some school districts that are extremely affirming of LGBT kids, where it's a wonderful place to grow up and go to school. So it really is kind of, it's all politics are local, and it goes right down to the school board when it comes to what's the experience going to be like for trans kids in a particular school district.
And then the whole point of something like a Title IX would be that it wouldn't be on a school district by school district basis.
Correct. And that's the interesting thing about education, which is we have very little federal law about education. Title IX, you have to comply with. But when it comes to curriculum and planning and all those, that's all local. And so school boards and school districts define what the curriculum is going to be and what the policies are going to be, subject only to Title IX. And any anti-discrimination law and the Constitution. So there is a lot of autonomy at the school board and a lot of agency at the school district level, but they have to be in compliance with those laws. And so that's where those legal challenges, those levers can be pulled by trans kids and their parents. If they're not in an affirming school district, they can say, listen, Title IX gives us some rights and we're going to pursue those.
You are a parent, and I'm wondering how your experiences just seeing the schools at a really granular level through a parent's eye view has shaped your awareness of like the details of how gender plays out in schools.
It has. And I've been very intentional about finding schools that are affirming to all kids across the gender spectrum. I have one quick story to tell. I have a daughter. She's now 11, but when she was 5, she cut her hair very short. She's a quote-unquote tomboy. She's often mistaken for a boy, even today. And she was in kindergarten and used the girls' bathroom, as is consistent with her gender identity. And a fifth grader said, you don't belong in here. And she had no voice because she was so small. And I went to her teacher and spoke, and they had a school-wide meeting. And the teachers and all the teachers had the same message in every classroom, which I think boils down to just a moment of brilliance, which is everyone knows which bathroom is right for them.
You know, you also bring up this issue of in schools, there is that that experience of being bigger than or smaller than that can really come into power dynamics in a way that is less so when you're a grown up. I mean, it's not gone when you're a grown up,
sure.
But it's the difference between a 5-year-old and a 10-year-old is like
huge.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why even putting into place anti-bullying policies, right, that includes bullying based on sexual orientation and gender identity can be very helpful. Setting aside, you know, which kid is going to use which bathroom, just having anti-bullying policies is really helpful to have.
What has the response to your article been like so far?
It's been positive. I've had outreach from press. I've had outreach from other scholars and folks that are just interested in hearing about, you know, what's going on, what are these challenges, what's the lay of the land. And as I say, right now, it's a little bit in flux given these cases at the Supreme Court, but we will know in June where this might fall. And the one thing that's good about both Title VII, which is what the court's hearing, and Title IX, is that those are both statutes that Congress passed. So if the court comes down and says, you know what, we don't think sex includes sexual orientation or gender identity, Congress can change it and actually put those words in. And so while I'm skeptical about a good outcome at the Supreme Court for various reasons that we should do another show on, it's fixable by Congress. And that's why all elections matter in this one in particular.
You know, I am curious when you think about this. This is a four-part argument that you have laid out, a four-part framework for it's not quite extending Title IX protections. It's interpreting Title IX and revisiting the idea of documents, really. I am curious if there was a moment that when you spelled it out, you realized you had really hit on something new.
A lot of scholars did a lot of great work before this article came, with all different bits and pieces that I kind of just pulled together into this comprehensive framework. So I certainly do not want to take credit for coming up with a new model or something that's groundbreaking. Rather, it's really collecting all that's out there. And then really, I think the work that this article does that wasn't done before is connecting the K-12 movement with the adult movement that's trying to change these gender marker requirements, particularly the surgical ones. Because kids can't have surgery, cannot have gender confirmation surgery until they're at least 18 and probably after that. And so these two things have some synergies, but these two subpopulations of the LGBT movement don't often work together. And I think that's the call that I'm putting out there, in addition to pulling all of the prior legal scholarship together.
What about, have you had a lot of communication with teachers?
I haven't, but I'd love to. If any of the school districts would like to reach out to me, I'd love to speak with them.
What do you think of as next steps for you? I mean, obviously, a lot of it comes down to the Supreme Court decision in June to determine what your next steps are. So if we imagine a scenario where the Supreme Court outcome is not what you are hoping for, what then are next steps for you?
Next steps are trying to get Congress, right, to either pass a new law that says we're going to protect based on sexual orientation and gender identity in schools and employment and public accommodations, or even start at the school district level, right? All politics truly are local. We could pass local ordinances. And in Kansas, there have been a handful in the past year that have passed city ordinances that says you can't discriminate in public accommodations based on sexual orientation and gender identity. We can start local. If we can't get the resonance we need in Congress, we can start in our communities and saying we're going to protect our community members from being turned away at the grocery store or forced to use the wrong restroom in a restaurant or at a school. And so we can start at every level, local, state, and national.
What do you find to be the trickiest arguments against what it is you're suggesting?
That's a great question. It's not so much that they're tricky, it's just that they get a lot of traction, right? There's a lot of fear-mongering and transphobia. When you saw HB2 in North Carolina, the bathroom bill there, we saw a lot of rhetoric and commercials about men dressing up as women and going into bathrooms and attacking cisgendered women, which just doesn't happen. And if it does, that's not a transgender person going in there and attacking a cisgender woman. It's a man dressing up as a woman. And we have ample criminal law to deal with that. But you get into that kind of rhetoric and it's hard to kind of break through and talk about. Transgender folks have been using the right bathroom for generations with no disruption. And there's been not one reported case that I'm aware of a transgender person ever assaulting anyone in a restroom. If anyone is vulnerable in a restroom, it's the transgender person who is very vulnerable to being harassed or assaulted in the restroom if they're seen as not supposed to be there.
Talk to me about that.
Well, for example, if we start to say you need to use the restroom that's aligns with your sex assigned at birth, and you look like a woman, and you go into the men's restroom, it's gonna result in harassment and violence. And so that's where we see it is trans people getting beat up in restrooms, not the other way around. And so it's hard to kind of shine a light on the real data when you have commercials and political rhetoric swirling around about protecting the safety of cisgendered women, which, like I say, is actually not an issue, and it's a complete non-issue.
When you talked about the Supreme Court case and your hopes being not super high about that outcome, let's just say that the outcome is that decision does grant, Title IX and Title VII both apply to the LGBT community. What in that scenario becomes your next step?
It would be to kind of operationalize that, right? And so in these states where there are where there's discrimination happening, either through policy, written policy, or through practice, hopefully we would see some self-correction, right? That school districts would say, hey, we see this coming down from the Supreme Court. It's time for us to do what's best. But that's where I think, again, advocacy and working across lines and having community conversations about here's the real data, here's the real evidence. Data says 1-3% of the population is transgender, which is about the same as redheads. So as many redheads as you know that many transgender folks. It's a significant part of the population. And I think it'll be time to stop basing our conversations in the fear and the rhetoric of fear and talking about let's build community and have these conversations.
When you spoke at the very beginning of our conversation about how students from a very young age are separated into boys over here, girls over here, and that framework has been really part of what's been problematic. How do you see that changing? Do you see if there was a legal change, that would certainly be a push?
Sure. Title IX does allow for separate sex segregated facilities like bathrooms and locker rooms as long as they're equal. But in terms of supporting all of the gender continuum, teachers can do very simple things, like instead of saying boys and girls, saying friends or colleagues. The same at law schools or in universities, and saying instead of saying Mr. or Mrs., you can say counselor or you can say students. And so there's ways to use gender neutral language that's really inclusive.
Kyle Velty, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Kyle is an assistant law professor at KU. She's just published an article on Title IX and LGBT protections in the Journal of Gender, Social Policy, and the Law. Up next, your weekly installment of the People's History of Kansas City on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and it's time for your Monday installment of the People's History of Kansas City with Suzanne Hogan. This week, we'll hear about a really important piece of Mexican-American history in this town, starting with the people who remember it because they lived it.
I can remember growing up as a kid here, I could go to almost every block in the neighborhood, and we had family members.
You know, you're like, man, why didn't I know that before? This is my history.
People didn't come to Kansas City knowing that's where they were going to end up.
Latinos started moving to Kansas City in the mid-1800s, way back in the early years, while the city was still establishing itself. The main draw was railroad work. Now, this was the line of work that literally made Kansas City a major epicenter of moving goods throughout the country. And it still is. Kansas City is the second largest rail hub to Chicago. Despite Latinos' major contributions to literally building the early infrastructure that made Kansas City what it is, there are a few local landmarks that credit their involvement or tell their story. On this episode, a history of Latino migration and integration into Kansas City, told through the story of one place called the Guadalupe Center, a place that is this history. I want to introduce you to my friend and colleague, Lisa Rodriguez, who dug into this for us. Hola, Lisa.
Hola, Suzanne.
So I know you, but other people might not. Tell us a little bit about who you are and why you wanted to tell this story.
Yeah, so I identify as Latina, and I grew up in the Kansas City area and kind of always knew about the Guadalupe Center. Now, I'm Chilean, not Mexican, but I feel like we went there when I was little for like parties or something. So it was something I vaguely knew about, but not the full story. So when I learned that it turned 100 years old last year, I thought it was crazy I didn't know more about it. You know, I actually learned that it's the oldest continuously operating Latino-serving organization in the country. And I feel like I wanted to know more about what's behind this place.
Yeah, that is an amazing fact. I didn't realize that it was that old. You know, as I mentioned in a previous People's History episode, I also identify as Latina. I have mixed Costa Rican and Ecuadorian heritage. And I've also always kind of known about this place growing up in Kansas City through family and friends and just everything that they do in the community. But I didn't realize how integral it was to Kansas City's whole Latino immigration story.
Right? Well, I'm going to start this story at, of all places, a gala.
Okay. Lisa, take it away.
Like I mentioned, Guadalupe Center celebrated its 100th year in 2019. And to celebrate, they threw one hell of a party. There was a live mariachi band, an auction, dancing, and great food. And I talked to tons of people who have never known a Kansas City without the Guadalupe Center.
I grew up right down the street from Guadalupe Center on Julio Cesar Chavez Boulevard.
I was born right across the street from Guadalupe School. My parents are from the west side.
I grew up on just like her, a block away from the center. I learned to play ball, go swimming.
That was Eddie and Lucy Muskies and Michael Coronado. But I heard this over and over again from everyone. People who have been going to the Guadalupe Center since they were born. And people who have seen the center evolve over the last century. It started to help Mexican workers who just arrived in Kansas City and faced discrimination. I say Mexicans because those are the immigrants who first used the Guadalupe Center. Today, the center is about much more than Mexican culture. Sure, a lot of people who use the center identify as Mexican or Mexican-American, but a lot identify as Hispanic, Chicano, Latino, Latina, and even Latinx. And while the language we use to describe people with roots in Central and South America has evolved, the issues they face are still very much the same. At the gala, the president of the Guadalupe Center's, Chris Medina, took a moment to talk to me about how far the center had come from its early days a century ago.
You know, it's ironic. We're still doing some of that stuff. and here we are in, 2019, and we're still talking about hate crimes and immigration and stuff. I thought we'd be beyond that. But
Chris Medina is a huge part of this story, and we'll get to that later in the episode. But what he says makes me think about how much the organization has actually changed. Although it was trying to address the same problems, the Guadalupe Center of 1919 didn't initially celebrate Mexican and Latino culture. The original Guadalupe Center was built to replace that culture. It's a story that involves war, the Catholic Church, even Tom Pendergast. At the turn of the 20th century, there were a couple different reasons Mexicans were moving to Kansas City. First was the Mexican Revolution. The country was really in upheaval. Secondly, there was a huge population boom in parts of Mexico, particularly in the state of Michoacán. So all these young, newly married men couldn't find land to start farms. A lot of them hopped on the brand new Mexican National Railroad to the U.S. border. And around that same time, World War I was starting, so American men were leaving to join war efforts, which means there were a bunch of open jobs, particularly on the railroads, and Kansas City was a major hub for that. Railroad companies from Kansas City even sent people to the border to recruit young Mexicans to come work here. Historian Valerie Mendoza says these men were happy to get a job no matter where it was.
If you're looking for a job coming from Mexico, right, this is like, of course, yes, I need a job. I'll go wherever you sent me. People didn't come to Kansas City knowing that's where they were going to end up, right? It was just where the work was needed.
Mendoza works with Humanities Kansas. She lives in Topeka now, so we meet in the middle in a coffee shop in Lawrence. Mendoza is particularly interested in how migration to Kansas City was different from other places closer to the border.
If you migrate to Texas, it's easy to get across the border, right? Especially during that period. You hear people speaking Spanish. You could find the foods that, you were familiar with.
Mendoza says fitting in places along the border was easy.
When you come to Kansas City, and that is not the case, you are one of the few, right? You stand out amongst the other people, even other immigrants.
So Kansas City sees this surge in Mexican immigration, mostly young men. And the group starts to look like kind of a bachelor community. After work, they're hitting up the bars and the pool halls and the boarding houses. Work on the railroad was tough. Some of the workers actually lived in boxcars. So it's natural they'd want to blow off some steam at the end of the day.
You know, this is the time of Tom Pendergast, too, right? Late 19-teens, early 1920s. So, you know, he was very much involved in those, you know, those bars and pool halls that catered to Mexicans. And so they get this reputation, right, of being lawless, most of it not deserved.
So you've got all these young men going back and forth from Mexico to Kansas City for seasonal work, living it up after long, tough hours on the railroad. And people were beginning to worry about the so-called Mexican problem. As part of the solution, the railroads encouraged the men to bring their families over, hoping it would bring some stability. And this is where the Guadalupe Center comes in. The idea was to Americanize these families. The Agnes Ward Amberg Club, a Catholic women's club made up of mostly rich, single Anglo women, starts a community center with a summer school for kids. And they call it the Guadalupe Center, after the patron saint of Mexico, Our Lady of Guadalupe. Also, that was the name of the church next door.
So it brought with it instant credibility. It brought with it even part of the culture of Mexico, right? Even though it wasn't run by Mexicans and that wasn't its purpose, just the name itself spoke volumes.
One of the leaders of the women's club, who to this day is known as the godmother of the Guadalupe Center, was Dorothy Gallagher. We don't have a lot of documentation of Gallagher's life outside the Guadalupe Center, but we know she came from a wealthy family in Kansas City and took a particular interest in this new Mexican community. A lot of the work the Guadalupe Center did in those early years focused on assimilating these new Mexican immigrants. Mendoza says the summer programs for kids were super popular, and it was easier to teach kids English and American customs.
And the thought was, oh, if we target women and children, then that will increase the Americanization among Mexican families. Children, because they're young and pliable, right? They learn things quickly. Mothers, because they have the authority over the home and the children.
The kids' programs were a success, but the sewing and cooking classes for the moms, they were a bit of a bust. The Mexican women were already excellent seamstresses and cooks. For these American women to try and teach them was insulting.
Why are you teaching me something I already know? Well, these club women wanted to teach the Mexican women how to make American food and how to clean homes, you know, to American standards.
Cleanliness. That was something a lot of welfare groups got hung up on. There had been an influenza epidemic in 1918, and an economic recession after the war led to layoffs at the railroads. The women running the Guadalupe Center saw families with tattered clothes and run-down homes, and instead of seeing hard times, they thought they were just dirty. So instead of offering health care or daycare, they offered public showers and trash pickup. It didn't take long for Dorothy Gallagher to realize they were going about this the wrong way. In those first few years, she'd been visiting the homes of people in the neighborhood, and they told her they didn't just want to learn English or how to clean a house. They wanted a place to gather and celebrate. So the Guadalupe Center had its first Gran Fiesta in 1926. There was dancing and music. The Mexican women made tortillas and other traditional dishes. And it was really popular. Valerie Mendoza says in addition to bringing the community together, it brought outsiders in to see the vibrant culture of these new immigrants.
And it kind of took away some of that stigma on the one hand. But on the other hand, it was also this culture that was seen as exotic that was on display, right? So it was kind of this double-edged sword.
Still, Mendoza says the fiesta started to give Mexican families more control.
It was like, oh wow, you know, we can do this. And so then the Guadalupe Center started hosting things like musical groups. They had folk dancing groups that they started that became very popular.
The center added more resources, a baby clinic, summer camps, a youth baseball team, and a student newspaper. And by 1935, the Guadalupe Center was so popular, it outgrew its facilities. The Agnes Ward Amberg Club didn't have the resources to handle an expansion, so Dorothy Gallagher used her own money to buy land for a new building. She drew up plans herself and hired an architect to design the building in a traditional Spanish mission style. If you drive along Avenida Cesar Chavez on the west side today, you'll spot it. It's the large tan stucco building with red roof tiles and curved facades. It's nestled near the bottom of a hill and faces the rest of the neighborhood's mix of modest and modern homes. Gallagher called the new building the living room of the neighborhood, and it truly became that. She actually lived there and apparently never took a paycheck. People gathered there for meetings and parties and weddings. Remember, the Guadalupe Center started as a place to Americanize new Mexican immigrants. But as these new immigrants began to speak up and find their voices in the community, the center evolved. So basically, the Latino families were beginning to Mexicanize the Guadalupe Center by using it for their own purposes. It kept some services, like English classes, but it also became a place to throw family events, make tortillas, gather, and socialize. And so it chugged along until World War II, when Gallagher, the driving force behind the center, left. Mexican families were finally getting some say in how things were run at the Guadalupe Center. And World War II happens, which sets into motion a series of events that transform the center once again over the next few decades. First, Dorothy Gallagher leaves to join the war efforts in Europe, along with many of the young Mexican-American men living in the West Side. By now, these are the sons of the families that moved here at the start of the 20th century. In Gallagher's place, the Catholic diocese takes over running the center. With the name Guadalupe after the Mexican patron saint, a lot of people already associated the center with the church, and many Mexican-Americans were Catholic, so the diocese had instant credibility with the community. But when these men came back from the war, having fought alongside Black, Anglo, and Hispanic men and women, they felt restricted by the church. By this time, the West Side had gotten crowded and Mexican families were spreading out to the suburbs and other parts of the city, but they were still segregated. This is about when the civil rights movement was taking shape. And researcher Teresa Torres says that tension was felt in the West Side neighborhood, too.
I think that you could say that it was this kind of growing awareness and consciousness of their own ability to be leaders that began to change the thinking of the youth and to say we all need to deserve to be treated equal.
Torres is a former board member of the Guadalupe Center. She's also a professor of Latinx studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and has been working on a project to educate people about the history of the Guadalupe Center. Torres says by the time the men got back from the war and settled back into daily life, they were tired of someone from outside their community running the show. That sentiment simmered and grew for years. And eventually, this group of young people decided to take some action. They wanted the Guadalupe Center to go from being a charitable organization run by the church to a real nonprofit that offers all kinds of services to the community. It all came to a head in 1974. The center had gone through several executive directors in quick succession. Community members serving on the board of directors selected someone from the community, Alfred Guillen, to take over. But the diocese had its own pick and overruled the community's choice, saying Guillen didn't have the experience for the job.
And in a meeting with the bishop, there were three representatives from the board, and one was an ex officio, Sister Carmen. And she said, essentially, well, how do we get someone to get experience and training if they've never been given a chance?
Torres says that was the real issue. People felt the church was keeping Latino people in their places as second-class citizens.
And that was really the argument the community was making. It's like, you know, how do you get people that are from us and that understand our community and our needs if you don't help us? And you always keep us as a secondary, that you're the ones, the great beneficiaries, to help the poor Mexicans.
The answer from the diocese was straightforward. Our way or the highway. They told the community to vacate the building. And that's when the Guadalupe Center split from the church. It was a rough couple years after that. There were several rounds of short-term directors, but eventually they got someone in charge who'd grown up with the center, Tony Salazar. When Salazar took over in 1978, his experience immediately brought legitimacy to the organization. He says it was time to get more professional.
You know, when I came in, there were no audits, for instance. There were funding there that hadn't been used.
Salazar took 2 years to overhaul the Guadalupe Center, but he doesn't take credit for what it is today.
I mean, that's Chris Medina, who I hired at that point. And he, you know, he really took that organization and took it to a much, much higher level.
Salazar gave an opportunity to a young accountant who grew up in the neighborhood and who had gotten bored of the business world. The Guadalupe Center we know today, a pillar of Kansas City that serves the needs of thousands of Latinos, may not be what it is had Chris Medina not been here. At this point, we've been through several different chapters of the Guadalupe Center's evolution. The early migration of Hispanics to Kansas City, the growing voice of Latinos in its services, and a hard-fought battle to reclaim control from the Catholic Church. This last chapter, from 1980 to today, we could safely call the Medina years. He's that important. Chris Medina's ties to the Guadalupe Center go back to its earliest days.
My mother's family came to Kansas City in 1919, and they settled on the west side. My great-grandmother, who came with 11 kids.
On a trip back to Mexico to visit family, his mother met a star futbolista, Chino Medina, who played for Atlas Guadalajara.
My dad was a big soccer star in Mexico. My dad played 10 years professional soccer in Mexico. In fact, he's in the record books, but he was scoring champion, the Mexican scoring champion, two times.
A large poster of his father in his uniform hangs on a wall in Medina's office at the Guadalupe Center. Photos and souvenirs cover the bright yellow walls, telling the story of his early life in Kansas City and the last 40 years he's been at the helm of this organization. Chris Medina was born in Mexico City, but his mother missed Kansas City, so they moved back to be closer to family. And when I say family, I mean lots of family. The Medinas are like Kansas City Mexican royalty.
Our last family reunion, we did it over at the Armory, and it's been a number of years now, but we had 900, 1,000 people there. So,
wow.
Yeah. I can remember growing up as a kid here, I could go to almost every block in the neighborhood and we had family members.
Starting in 1980, when Medina took over as executive director of the Guadalupe Center, the organization transformed. Anything the community needed, the center found a way to do it. They noticed Latino dropout rates at area high schools was high, so they started an alternative high school in 1990. The Guadalupe charter system now has an elementary, middle, and high school, and two preschools. They saw that people were having trouble getting loans, so they started a credit union. After a spike in teen pregnancies, they set up a program to educate and help teenagers and young mothers. The list goes on and on. Workforce training, wellness courses, senior bingo. The Guadalupe Center now operates 18 buildings with a staff of more than 300 people. But most important to Medina is creating an environment to foster leadership in young people.
If we're going to have our population be successful and provide for themselves, we need to give them the tools to be able to do that, where they can find decent jobs, paying a livable wage, where they can provide for themselves.
After all, that's how the Guadalupe Center became what it is today. It may have been started by a group of white women as a solution to a problem, but it evolved. And when the time was right, it was turned over. And after a prolonged fight with the diocese, it was reclaimed by the very people it was created to serve. Chris Medina still appreciates Dorothy Gallagher for letting go of the reins when she did.
But when she left, she goes, my work's done here. And I really appreciate that, because she said what she had done was empowered the people where they could lead themselves. And that was huge. Just, hey, she got it. Too bad the diocese didn't.
Medina says there are new challenges every day. For one, his neighborhood is changing. New young populations are attracted to the West Side, and some of the Hispanic people who have lived there for generations are being priced out. the latest property reassessments from the county saw some home values spike up to 500%. As it always has, the Guadalupe Center is adapting. Medina says they're looking to develop a mortgage loan program to help buy some of the rental properties in the area and give people an affordable place to live. And they're helping seniors fix their home and find responsible buyers.
One area that we need to really develop that we have not done a real good job at is getting elected officials, people to run for public office. So there's a lot of challenges there.
Now, Medina is looking at the next generation of leaders to represent the Kansas City Latinx community in the coming decades. It's an uphill battle, but Hispanic people in Kansas City are used to uphill battles. The Guadalupe Center now provides services for Latinos from dozens of different countries spread across the metro. And like Medina said at that party, while the population the center serves may be different, a lot of their challenges, discrimination, assimilation, hate crimes, are the same as they were 100 years ago, which is why Medina says it's important to share the history of Latinos in Kansas City because it's not new. And if no one else is stepping up to the plate to help this community thrive in the future, then the Guadalupe Center will, because that's just what the Guadalupe Center does.
Lisa Rodriguez brought us that story for the People's History of Kansas City. The podcast, hosted by Suzanne Hogan, is a collaboration between KCUR and the Mid-Continent Public Library, and that is a wrap for today on KCUR's Central Standard. We spoke earlier in the show with Kyle Velty of KU, who's proposed a legal framework for extending Title IX protections to the LGBTQ community in American schools. That story and the one you just heard will be online at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. Tomorrow, the diary of a Kansas Cityan living in China for some perspective on the coronavirus experience so far, including what it was like to take in the big Super Bowl win under quarantine. Tune in tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.